So now if you want to turn in the bulletin to the sermon text, which is Exodus 7, 1-7. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to cover a bunch of the plagues in this Exodus scene. But I'm just going to read these verses here, and that will be sort of our jumping off spot for the sermon. Let me read these to you. Exodus 7, starting in verse 1. And the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them." Moses and Aaron did this. They did just as the Lord commanded them. Now Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. This is the word of the Lord. Well, I don't know if maybe I've just been thinking about times past here lately. Midlife crisis or something, I don't know, whatever it is. But I was thinking this week reading this passage about an old youth group song. I think Tim Gustafson's been singing in his head all week. There's this old song, you might know it, about Pharaoh. It's sung to the tune of Louie Louie, because nothing says liturgical music like Louie Louie. Even had hand motions. You might not be surprised to find that even in youth group, I was like, I'm not doing hand motions. So, as Daniel says, I've always been an old man. Plus, nothing like America to take a dreadfully dark scene in the scriptures and turn it into a song with hand motions. We're so optimistic about everything. I think that thinking about sort of Exodus themes and imagery, I actually think that the old African American spirituals do a better job than Louie Louie. It's a low bar, but still do a better job of getting at the pathos of the Exodus. You don't think Louie Louie's? No, I'm not going to sing it. So I'm so sorry. That's not true. I won't lie to you. I'm not sorry at all. I'm still not going to sing it. So, and I will not do a hand motion. So anyway, thank you, Randy, for... I do think, though, that African-American spirituals get at the pathos of the Exodus so much better than do most of these kind of youth group tunes, because the Exodus and everything going on around the Exodus is full of like anguish and pain and suffering, and it's deep. So to do hand motion seems a little bit disingenuous. Now, the plague sequence, so for those of you that had a chance, I hope read it ahead of time, you may see some of this coming. If you didn't read it this week, and maybe you remember from the past, that what happens here is that the Lord sends in Moses and Aaron to tell Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Pharaoh doesn't do it, and the Lord brings along this series of plagues. There are 9 that we'll look at today, and there's one more that we'll look at in a couple of weeks. And in each of these plagues, like the scenery, the imagery is not hand motion-y. It is anguished and it's painful. Now, this is the thing that is, I think, perhaps missed, though, as we read that. Now, we think of the Exodus, and this is the part that I think that a lot of the old spirituals get right, is the emotion of it. But as we read through the plagues, the emotion and the anguish and the suffering in this series of events is actually not on the Israelites. It's actually on the people in Egypt. And particularly, the anguish and the emotion and the challenge lands on the representative head of Egypt, Pharaoh. Now, this is something that we don't usually, or I haven't always paid attention to. So what I want us to do this morning is taking a really like high-level like flyover of the plagues is look at, well, what about Pharaoh? So with promises that at some point the sermon series on the life of Moses will actually get back to Moses, I want us to focus on Pharaoh a little bit this morning. And here's the first thing I want us to notice is this, that Pharaoh actually gets his question answered. Pharaoh really does, in this series of events, get his question answered. You might wonder, what was the question? So back in chapter 5, verse 2, Pharaoh asks, and I presented to you that probably pretty snarky tones, asked this question, oh yeah, well, who's Yahweh? Because Moses and Aaron show up and say, Yahweh says, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, who's that? Not because he hadn't heard of him, but because what Pharaoh was saying was, Yahweh, I'm in charge here. It's my country. Those slaves are my slaves. Who's this Yahweh? He was basically saying that Yahweh's no big thing to me because I'm Pharaoh. He ruled over Yahweh's people, didn't he? He was the king. They were slaves in his kingdom, so who's in charge here? Pharaoh is saying, hey, I am. Who's Yahweh? So who is Yahweh? Well, who indeed is the answer when we start looking at this series of plagues? So again, I decided to take a huge flyover of these things, but I want us to notice what happens in the plagues. The plagues are presented in three cycles of three plagues each, up until, so that gets you through nine, and that sets up the last big one, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. But each of these cycles of three plagues are presented as a judgment on Egypt, as we saw in the text that I read earlier. But what we see is, if you read through these on your own, you'll see that, yeah, it's on Egypt, but these are getting like zeroed in on Pharaoh himself. The cycles of plagues go like this. First, the Nile is turned to blood. That's in chapter 7. Then you get all these frogs that show up and just infest the land. That would be gross, by the way. And then you go from frogs to dust, and then dust turns into gnats. That's the first cycle of plagues. This is incredibly inconvenient. But then come the next cycle of plagues. In chapter 8, verse 20, there are these flies everywhere. If you've ever camped with bugs around, like, no, the flies. They're everywhere. And then the Egyptians' livestock dies. And if that's not enough, in chapter 9, the end of chapter 9, everybody's got boils. This is just, we've gone from inconvenient, having to dig water. You know, the Nile's turned to blood, so great, now we've got to dig for water over here. We go from the inconvenience of that to frogs, to gnats, the flies get really pestery, then all of a sudden the livestock's dying, and now I've got boils. And that's the end of the second cycle. But then come the third cycle of plagues or judgments. There's this fiery hail that falls from the sky. And then here come livestock. So whatever's been left after the fiery hail, if you're looking at the plants around and what hasn't been beaten down by the fiery hail, well, great, here come the locusts to pick everything else clean. So that comes through. And as though that's not enough, then there's just utter darkness. Well, I don't know if you've ever been in utter darkness before. It's frightening. So these are these three cycles of plagues. And the thing that we can't miss is that these three cycles of plagues, these judgments, they strike at the heart of Egyptian life. Each one of these things gets at stuff that Pharaoh and the gods are supposed to take care of. The Nile was the source of all, it's like life sort of moved around the Nile. Agriculture, everything. And here we have all of these plagues that keep beating down all these very specific things that, hey, Pharaoh is supposed to be able to do something. He's got an in with the gods. He sees himself as one of the biggest of all. But yet with all of these plagues, with all of these judgments, what we see is that over and over again, what can Pharaoh do about that? He seems utterly out of control over all of these things that he's supposed to be utterly in control of. In each of the three cycles, there are also two warnings that come along with them. In each cycle, two warnings. And in each of these places, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. In all the nine plagues that we are sort of covering this morning, Pharaoh was completely bereft of any control to do anything about it. The plagues were a relentless assault on Pharaoh's self-rule. So the first thing I want us to see is this. Pharaoh gets his question answered loudly. Who is Yahweh, Pharaoh? Look around, Pharaoh. Who is this Yahweh? He's the God over all these things, and you are not. Now, that leads us to a second thing I want us to notice from this whole sort of plague scene, and it's this. Not only does Pharaoh get his question answered, but we also see Pharaoh just has this stubborn and persistent resistance to what he's told to do. Now, again, if you had a chance to read these ahead of time, and if not, I'd encourage you to read them later. Pharaoh keeps getting chance after chance. Pharaoh, let my people go. With warnings that go along with it, all along the way. 6 warnings. And all of these times, with all of these chances, Pharaoh continues to go through cycles of saying, no, I won't, then, okay, I will. And then, no, I won't. And then, yes, I will. And then, no, I won't, no, I won't. And then, yes, I will. But at the end of all of those, he still says no. Involved in those cycles, there's some sort of like conniving and bargaining that goes on with Pharaoh. But at the end, he still says no. No. And it's important for us, I think, to notice that his answer of no was in the face of mounting evidence that he was not in as much control as he would like everyone else to think he was. I mean, the evidence is piling up. By the time you get to the 9th plague, like, okay, Pharaoh, listen, you're not in charge. You can't do anything about this. Let his people go. And in fact, even some of the other leaders are saying, Pharaoh, I mean, it's the Egyptian version of, for crying out loud, man, let these people go. Look around. But he doesn't. He's persistent in saying no. And it's also interesting that the evidence becomes really stark when you consider what's happening in Goshen. Now, if you don't recall, Goshen is where the Israelites lived. And in all these plagues, you know what the Israelites are doing? They're kind of sitting pretty. Their livestock's fine. They've got the food they need. Everything is going really just quite fine in Goshen. So I think that this evidence continues to mount up. Like, Pharaoh, who's in charge? Like, look at the people of Yahweh. They're okay. And look at us. Now, the evidence militates against Pharaoh being in charge. But also notice that not only is there mounting evidence that he's not in charge, but there's also evidence that all of his persistent, stubborn resistance is like wreaking havoc on everybody. And sure, the consequences put some weight on Pharaoh. He's losing face, and he's losing confidence, and he's losing power. But notice even more that his stubborn resistance to the rule of Yahweh places a terrible weight on the people he's supposed to be leading. I mean, you think about the Egyptians. They start, Pharaoh's stubbornness and his unwillingness to let God's people go starts with inconvenience, and then it gets uncomfortable. And at the very end, in this 9th plague of darkness, Pharaoh's people are paralyzed by fear. In chapter 10, verse 23, they won't even go out. At this point, they are so afraid, they're so beaten down, they can't even leave. It's not just that he's missing the point of the evidence. His stubborn persistence in trying to pretend that he's the one that's in charge is wreaking havoc on so many people around him. And one of the curious realities, I think, in this passage is that, and this is something I didn't really think about until this past week, it's not as though Pharaoh didn't have a legitimate job to do. I mean, notice in the text, the issue here is not whether or not Pharaoh should be king. This is not some sort of an apologia that's sort of against monarchy. This text is not some sort of apologia for Western democracy. It's not. It's not saying, oh, see, Pharaoh, if he would just say no more kings. That's not what this passage is doing. Pharaoh's problem here is not his political ideology. Pharaoh's problem is that he won't submit to Yahweh. It's not as though the Lord says, Pharaoh, step down. That'll solve everything. No, what Pharaoh should have done was be a king that's willing to love mercy and to do justice and to walk humbly. It's not a problem of what kind of rule, what kind of political framework. It's a problem of Pharaoh saying, no, I'm in charge. He could have done the right thing. He could have been the kind of king that says, you know what, you're right. I should let these people go. Make the right decision and move on, and there's that. But he doesn't do that. He persists in his stubbornness. And that even allows us, to chime in on one of the big, like, difficult issues of this text or of any talk about Pharaoh. And that's the issue of who's hardening his heart. I mean, that's always the fun question to ask here, too. Who is hardening Pharaoh's heart? Because sometimes it says God is, sometimes it says Pharaoh's hardening his own heart. How should we handle that? Well, we might consider some philosophical answers to that. We can talk about agencies, secondary causes, foreknowledge, categories of decrees, all those kinds of things that we might talk about. And can I just tell you, like, I think that just kicks the can down the road. That never really answers the question. It just reframes the questions. We could do that, though. Maybe that's fruitful. Or we could take a sort of a cultural view on this and recognize that in the Hebrew mindset, because of their view of God's sovereignty, at some point or another, it's all under God's control. So whether Pharaoh's hardening it or God's hardening it, those two things are basically interchangeable anyway. So we can say from a cultural standpoint, like, well, what difference does it make what it says? They're both kind of doing the same thing. They both involve the other. But even if that maybe softens the edges of some of our philosophical questions, it still leaves the philosophical questions unanswered. Now, I think all of those things are worth discussing. But at the end of the day, this text is not presenting to us a philosophical question. And at the end of the day, this text is not presenting to us a cultural question. The emphasis of this text is it's a question of who is in charge. Pharaoh is not. At some point, Pharaoh needed to get to the same answer that the Apostle Paul drags us to in Romans 9, which basically says, you know what? At some point, we have to say, well, the Lord is God. The Lord is God and not me. At some point, we have to say, well, I don't always get to run the place, because God is in charge and I'm not. And at some point, we have to wrestle with the fact that we don't always get to choose everything that we want. There are times when we just have to say, the Lord is God. And in a sense, kind of deal with it, although that feels like such a terrible way to say it. We don't always get to choose what we want. And in spite of the mounting evidence of our own inability to rule the world, and in spite of all the consequences that our attempts to rule the world foist upon other people, at some point, we have to say, the Lord is God and not me. And the reality is that we hate that answer. We do. We hate the idea that God is in charge and we're not. See, Pharaoh's resistance was stubbornly persistent. And the sad fact is that so often, so is ours. Stubbornly persistent. Because we don't want to admit that the Lord is God and not me. But that brings us to this issue, so what do we do then? Well, I think we have to wrestle with the same question that Pharaoh had. Who is Yahweh? It's the question Pharaoh had, and it's maybe in some ways the question that I'm presenting to you. Who is this God? Who is this God that you show up week after week to sing songs about and to hear me talk about and other people talk about? The question is, will we believe that the Lord is God and we're not? Will we bow before this God who says, I'm the God over all things? And it's a strange problem of our hearts, and it demonstrates how much sin and all of its descriptions have made a mess of things, is that we don't want to give up on the illusion that we're in control. But we don't want to give up this idea that, no, I do run things, even though there's mounting evidence that we can't control things. And we don't want to give up on our self-rule, even though if we were to look around, we'd see the ways that our persistent stubbornness wreaks havoc on people around us. You see, all along, Pharaoh's answer should have been, okay, apparently Yahweh is the Lord, and I'm going to do what he says. Okay, we'll do it your way. That would have helped everyone involved. But like Pharaoh, we become so clouded by our self-orientation that we don't even realize that by toppling the idol of self, the idol that we tend to bow to most, and by bowing to Yahweh, if we would do that, we're actually able to live out in the glory we're created for. I mean, again, Pharaoh probably could have been a great king. Loving mercy, doing justice, walking humbly before Yahweh. And the reality is that so many of us, we would be able to live out the glory that we're made for as a creature under the loving rule of a creator. But sometimes in our attempt to hang on to the illusion of the throne, we're making life more and more difficult on ourselves, and the same for others around us. We could be creatures bearing the image of God and all of humanity's created glory, but we keep choosing the dregs of self-rule over that. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. We think so often that being ruled by somebody else is a terrible thing. What we want is we want freedom, right? We want autonomy. And we don't get is that by choosing and clinging to self-rule, we're actually submitting to the very tyrant we ought to overthrow. So what do? Well, at some point we have to bow to Yahweh. We have to bow to this God who rules over all. And this is where I want to start turning us back around to the tone of the rest of the service. It's this, think about, but who is Yahweh? Who is this Yahweh that says that he rules over all things and we must submit to him? What is this God really like? I know I've quoted Psalm 85 before, and I'm sure I will again. So in 7 years, I've probably quoted it several times. Prepare for it again, because I love this psalm. Because here's what Psalm 85 says, starting in verse 10, talking about the Lord. It says, "Steadfast love and faithfulness meet. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. Faithfulness springs up from the ground, and righteousness looks down from the sky. Yes, the Lord," there's that name, Yahweh. "Yes, Yahweh," if we wanted to read it that way, "will give what is good. And our land will yield its increase. Righteousness will go before him and make his footsteps away." Listen, this God who does indeed call us to really absolute and total obedience and allegiance to him. And we can't make any mistake, but we can't soften that. God calls us to live under his rule. That's true. But this God who calls us is not calling us as some sort of a capricious fiend. Oh, he's the best kind of father, the kind of father whose rules are rooted in his unbending affection for his people. It's that kind of God. This kind of ruler exercises his own rule by sacrificing himself for a people who keep throwing these fruitless coups. This God that calls us to bow to him, this is the God that takes the just judgments of our rebellion on himself. And he does so that there really can be a way. There's some imagery of love. There really can be a way, because this God takes upon himself our judgment. There is a way back finally to that sloppy lip lock of steadfast love and faithfulness, righteousness and peace together. All because of what this God does. This kind of God. At some point, we must give in to his love as it's wildly displayed in Jesus. Because when we finally give in to the love of this God, we will have given in to the rule of this God. And I think that is a thing that we miss so much. This God who calls you to bow before him is a God that loves you. Now, I've recently seen a commercial, quote, talking about commercials in sermons is always a little bit sketchy. This may be a lot sketchy. We'll see. You may have seen it if you watched any football games lately. If not, I'll just describe it to you. It's a medieval banquet scene where these lines of subjects, or people that have seen it are smiling. They come before the king, and they're bringing, some size of, usually it's a beverage, basically. So they come and they drop off before the king, and they set it down on the table, and the king who's sitting there receives the gift and basically, says, "Thank you for bringing this here." And then the king proclaims, "Dilly dilly," and the rest of the crowd goes, "Dilly dilly." Now, I think "dilly dilly" is actually an anachronism, by the way. I think that was from the late 1800s. But anyhow, it's a beer commercial, so I shouldn't set my expectations so high. At any rate, the idea here is that these subjects of the king show up with what they have, and they set it on the table, and the king, receives it, except for one of them, but that's a whole different story. The king receives it, and his proclamation is, if he accepts it, "Dilly dilly," and then everybody else says, "Dilly dilly," there you go. That's fun. Listen, so for some of us, the problem of bowing before this God comes down to the fact that we don't want to surrender the illusion of our self-rule. We're really committed to our own rule. In spite of all the evidence, in spite of all the carnage it creates, we just don't want to do it. That's, some of you might have that problem today. For some of us, the problem with coming and bowing before and bringing ourselves to the King is because we're too ashamed to humbly bow because we know the wreckage that we've felt and created. So the thought of coming to the King is just too much, so we put up a front and we refuse to do it. For some of us, those two things go hand in glove. They really go together. Our attempts at self-rule and our shame, they're bound up together in ways that make it hard to come before the King. But you know, the Lord who reigns over all things has a funny way with folks. He has a funny way with folks that show up to his banquet, because if you come to him humbly this morning, just the way that you are, if you show up with all the stuff that you have and humbly bow to his love, you know what he promises to do? To receive you. Because he's already done what's required to deal with all of that stuff, to deal with the guilt of it, to deal with the shame of it. See, the way that you bow this morning, I mean, the passage, this whole Pharaoh passage is basically screaming out, Pharaoh's not king. Pharaoh should have just said, I am clearly not in charge here. I'm going to bow to Yahweh. You guys can go, right? We've got to get to the place where we're willing to say, okay, I am not in charge. But look who is. This God who pours himself out in both faithfulness and love, in righteousness and in peace together. The way that you bow this morning is to come with all you have, your gifts, your stories, your hurts, your shame, your stubborn rebellion, all of that stuff, and to come to the banquet, as it were, with all of that stuff and say, you know what? This is what I've got, and set it on the table. It's not pretty. I mean, look at this. It's not pretty. It's to come with all that stuff and say, this is what I don't, these are my questions, these are my frustrations. This is what I've done. This is what I wish that I could have done. These are all the things that I wish I were better at, and these are all the things I keep failing at over and over again. These are the things that I find great joy in. These are the things that I break down in tears over because I can't fix them. That's been part of my week. The tears over the things that you think, I can't fix it. Why can't I fix this? And part of it's because I have to say, I'm not God. I'm not you. And I'm going to come and bow before you with all of this stuff. And I'm going to set it here at the table. I'm not pretty, Lord, but I'm going to be yours. I bow before you. And you know what his answer to that is? It's the God version of, well, dilly dilly. Can you imagine? To bring all the stuff that you've experienced and set it before the King and him say, well, dilly dilly. It's hard to imagine, I know. But much like last week, it's not an intricate message for you this morning. It's not. But I feel some measure of, I felt some measure of compulsion the last couple weeks to return these basic exhortations to Christ. And like last week, I'll say that, you know, I understand that bowing before this God who demonstrates himself in this amazing, loving way in Jesus, it does take some thought and effort. Like, what does that look like in my circumstances? And I'd love to talk to you about that. But here we have yet again another call to just come and bow before this God who is God. You're not. Let's stop fighting against that. And bring all that we have and set it before our King and hear his word of loving acclamation to us. Because in this case, Bob Dylan was right. Beer commercial, Bob Dylan, check. Bob Dylan was right that we all have to serve somebody. So whose ruler are you going to bow to this morning? Yours with all that it brings with it, all the carnage, all the frustration? Or will you bow before the King of love who's given himself for you? Let's pray. Father in heaven, I can't speak on behalf of these friends that are here in front of me, but with all that I have this morning, I'm going to try to bow. And I pray that as we go to the Lord's table now, that we would hear your voice with I'm sure there's a better way to describe it, but we would hear that proclamation that you receive us. That Lord, as we come this morning and humbly bow, that we would hear your words of love and acceptance of us, not because of what our hands have done, but really only because we've come and humbly bow before you and accepted what you've done for us. So you who are the God over all, I bow this morning. And I pray that in your righteousness and in your faithfulness, in your justice and in your love, that you would reign over me. And I pray that all who would say that same thing or something like it, that they would come to this table this morning and hear the dilly-dilly of the God of heaven. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.